Thank you, Dr. McDowell. Our next speaker is Professor William Harvey of the Indiana Law School, who will be addressing us on the Legal Services Corporation. Professor Harvey?
Jim, members of the panel, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Using the speaker's perhaps discretion, I've decided to alter the title just a bit from what Jim has stated. The title of my address is Legal Positivism, The Theory Becomes a Fully Developed Political Program. In an effort to state this as quickly as I can and within time, I'll summarize these comments among several perhaps terse paragraphs with the acceptance of the piercing eye of an historian of the prominence of Forrest MacDonald or other colleagues, such as Carl Lusker and Maury Holland. Here is the summary, which I think is a preliminary to the explanation which Jim has introduced. The first comments are these. The case and controversy limitation in Article 3 of the Constitution was designed as an effective and very powerful control over the exercise of state power in the form of judicial decree or federal judicial power. The central limitation which it contains is not found in court-created doctrine which use such words as standing or ripeness or representation or maturity or mootness. Those doctrines have received thousands of pages of attention in 20th century court opinion, but compared with the principal control mechanism established in Article 3, they are not significant. The control mechanism in case or controversy and the limitation which is found in Article 3 is found in the common law and its development, and both the common law restraint and the common law's evolution were squarely placed in Article 3. The control mechanism in the development of all the common law, for which reason it was one of the genuine spontaneous social systems, like language itself, if I may attempt to speak in Hayekian terms, was the restriction naturally found in the decisional process in which a person decided to allocate sufficient assets to the development of a suit or a case, rather than the allocation of those assets to other activities or pursuits. In short, state judicial power, particularly federal judicial power, was made dependent on individuals, and only those individuals who engaged in that allocation of personal assets. We may say that but for that individual's function, then judicial power did not exist in the sense that it could not function or be used. The presence of that restriction permitted the great Chief Justice John Marshall, and in my judgment we've had only one great Chief Justice, to interpret the provisions of the Constitution as he did, very expansively in almost every instance. He knew that judicial power, which he recognized, could not function or develop without a personal decision and a personal commitment, which is observed in the allocation of assets to litigation rather than new farm machinery, your son's education, or the storage of ice in the summer if you lived at Monticello. In that system, rights were not discovered, and constitutions did not mean what the last decision day disclosed. Rights were pre-existent, and only those rights which were of sufficient importance to compel the allocation of assets for judicial enforcement would indeed be judicially enforced or recognized, although all other rights certainly existed, whether a court spoke to them or about them or not. In that system, not every right, therefore, was offered up for enforcement. The central question for the individual concerned a choice. I must choose to give greater recognition to one right rather than another by allocating enough of my assets to the recognition or to its recognition or enforcement by a court. If I do, then I take away from other rights which I have, such as the right to commit those funds and those assets to the purchase of ice cream or the development of my 40 acres along with my mule. When this 19th century opened, we were protected, all of us, from state power in the judiciary by that system, and no person better understood this than Chief Justice Marshall, as he so beautifully expressed it, particularly in his private law opinions and his dissent in Ogden v. Saunders. It's small wonder that the 20th century persons such as Felix Frankfurter carefully avoided public discussion and certainly approval of Marshall's private law opinions. When the 19th century closed, all of that had been swept away in theory by legal positivism. In its reigning theory, rights were those decrees which a court would enforce. In this theory, law consists of that which a court will enforce. And in this theory, law becomes nothing more than a court's order, and precedent was only a negotiable item and thus very changeable. When the 19th century closed, this system was fully operative in the halls of the legislature, although not yet in the courts. This legislative system received enormous support from the Supreme Court in the Slaughterhouse cases in 1873, which cases effectively repudiated the political meaning of the Civil War, the 14th Amendment, and Mr. Lincoln. The Slaughterhouse cases made racial segregation inevitable, and they made Plessy v. Ferguson of 1896 inevitable. Plessy approved the result of legal positivism run rampant in the halls of the legislature. Legal positivism has remained a powerful force and very widely accepted because its principal products, such as racial segregation, have never been assigned to it. Oliver Wendell Holmes came upon the scene at that time. The Supreme Court's supreme legal positivist, advanced the philosophical program which placed legal positivism in the courts, which gutted the common law, which gutted the Constitution of John Marshall, and which overturned and made almost useless the case and controversy limitation in Article 3. Under this doctrine, rights can exist only when they are recognized by a court's decree or in an administrative agency's order or grant of approval for future conduct or some other allocation of power arising from a judicial or administrative practice. Under this doctrine, rights have no preexistence. There is no philosophical theory from which they emerge, whether social contractarian or even, permit me to say for just a moment, Marxist communitarianism. Perhaps the best description of Holmes and all that he and his followers created is found in the following exchange between a baseball player and the umpire. The baseball player stood at bat, and the pitcher threw the ball. The catcher caught the ball. The batter, turning to the umpire, who was Bill Clem, said, "Well, what is it, Bill, a ball or a strike?" And the umpire returned, saying, quote, "It ain't nothing till I call it," end of quote. If this theory is to prevail and was to prevail in the face of such documents as the Constitution, then it became imperative that it receive actual implementation. Only the state, which it must do under Holmes's doctrine, can replace the system of asset allocation which persons performed. Our question today is this: did the state do this? Or our questions are, did the state do this? And what are the contours of action which identify such a program if the state has done it? What would we expect to find? I ask this question in a kind of prospective sense, and I do suggest that perhaps we can expect to find the evidence of certain social phenomenon or a causal connection, indeed, and we can do this in other countries. I suggest to you that we can look at the ramblings and rumblings of a Hans Kelsen or a Carl Schmitt in the 1920s, and that we can indeed establish a causal relationship between that or those and Auschwitz-Birkenau and Theresienstadt and the Waffenstut Shuffle. And it's that in that context that I ask the question today, what can we identify which exists among us today as the implementation of Holmesian legal positivism? What is the nature of such an organization, and what would we expect to find? I think first that we'd expect to find an organization which has millions of persons assigned to it as a class or group, which millions of persons, of course, have had this assignment made without their knowledge, without their understanding, even without their knowledge of the existence of the organization. Nevertheless, they are taken, plucked out, and arbitrarily assigned to it. The only relationship among them is a specific status, and that status has to do with a certain income level on a W-2 form. I think we'd expect to find an organization which is organized and authorized to recognize only those claims from among those millions of persons which it chooses to recognize and no others, claims which might belong to one or more of these millions of persons. We would look for an organizational apparatus which serves the state in that it selects, the apparatus selects for the state, those claims which the state's courts will enforce, thus giving claims the status of rights, so to speak, but only in that way. We would look for an organization in which the state provides, and to which it provides, millions of dollars each year, approximately $500 million each year in final total income. And so, therefore, we would look for an organization which, if in corporation or corporate form, would have and did have, in 1981, a net income considerably greater than General Motors Corporation. We would look for an organization which would list among the Fortune 100 service corporations as the third largest net income organization in America, and third only to Philbrow Solomon of New York and Halliburton of Dallas, Texas. We would look for an organization which would have a net income larger than all but five banks in the United States, an organization which had in 1981 an income double that of the entire Mellon Bank System of Pennsylvania. We would look, because of this, we would look for an organization which by its very definition of function must totally plunge into direct political activity. We would look for an organization which might indeed be the most sophisticated political program in America today. An organization, if we can find muniments of title or elements of existence, an organization which has provided hundreds of thousands of dollars to defeat initiatives on state ballots which it deems as harmful. Of course, all of that provision of money was in direct violation of the law, but no one really enforces the law against an organization like this. We would look for an organization which has a political apparatus considerably more powerful and more sophisticated than our open political parties. We would look for an organizational function which placed hundreds of thousands of dollars into the ratification of ERA and almost alone won that in the state of Illinois. We would look for a political system which can place 300 letters from across the United States to any point or any office on any subject in no more than 36 hours' notice and cause each one to seem to be individually written and therefore with a kind of groundswell of spontaneity which seems to be so impressive upon the gang of 535 in Washington. We would look for an organization which, in fact, maintains an investigatory function as sophisticated as the Federal Bureau of Investigation. If we can find an organization with all of these qualities, all of these features, then we know that Holmesian and Poundian legal positivism is no longer simply an assertion in the Harvard Law Review. Indeed, it has become a fully implemented form, that it is, because of that form, infinitely more significant than the exchange of letters between Holmes and Lasky or Pollock or whatever it is that you prefer to read in that area. We would know that the meaning of rights, their assertion, their recognition, and their protection, which was established in the Constitution of 1789, has been lost. Rights as a word, or is a word, which is used simply as a cover for total political activity and a totally political program. And with this, I conclude. Jim McClellan said, I'm here to discuss the Legal Services Corporation. Ladies and gentlemen, I have just discussed it. Thank you, and good afternoon. Thank you, Bill.